So as you know well by now, I would invite you to turn to Psalm 78, encourage you to turn to the psalm, and that we might study here for a time this morning. I wonder, did you recognize the story that this psalm tells? You're certainly supposed to. We are supposed to. The readers, the first readers, were supposed to recognize the story. The first hearers, if it was sung, as you might expect, from Asaph, the leader of the music of the temple. Now, it is a long psalm, 72 verses. But however long it is telling a story in brief, very brief, a much fuller story that is to be found in the law, as it was called, the book of the law, the books from Exodus, particularly through Numbers and Deuteronomy. It's a psalm of reminders to recall events. It's not new. But it's to recall events with a view to dwelling on their significance. You know, there are times today where you only need to mention, say, one name or one incident. For example, today you will often hear people make reference to, bear with me, Hitler. And we understand a great deal wrapped up in that. It refers to a wide range of events. Before the war and during the war and so on. Well, that's really what you have intended here. Just a few things that are spoken of, relatively just a few, that are referred to remind the people of so much more around it. Brief mention of certain incidents in Israel's story so that the whole of the event will be brought to mind. But what matters most in the psalm is not merely the passage of events, that you, as it were, that this was a children's Bible storybook that they could open and just remind themselves of what happened. That's not primarily what the psalm is about. It tells us of these things, but it is most concerned about why, the significance. It's most concerned about how Israel responded. It's most concerned about what God was at work to do. Most important of all is this. How well did Israel recognize God at work amongst them in those various circumstances that are told? Just before opening this up a little further, I would like to just come back to Asaph. The psalm begins a contemplation of Asaph, and I think it's something that it's worth your while knowing, that Asaph is the name of one of the men that was appointed by David to lead the music in the temple worship. He was a Levite, which was the same tribe that the priests came from. All the different workers in and around the temple were from this tribe. So it was, we are told, it's a contemplation of Asaph thinking through things. But was it Asaph himself? Was it this man, this individual that David appointed? Well, there are suggestions, there's the full content of the psalm that would almost suggest that it carries, it comes up in much later, that it carries certain ideas and information that can't really come from David's own time. And so if Asaph here, while it is in the title, it may mean that it was composed by someone in his family line who were kept in that role, in the music in the temple, or someone who served in that capacity. So just to bear that in mind, that there are certain things here that maybe can't be understood as being written directly by that one individual. Now, as we come to the psalm, it is a long one. I intend to try and show you something of the shape of the psalm, and how that shape, we might call it, conveys God's crucial message for his people, both then and now. And the key parts, I think, that we might note in particular are, first of all, the call to listen, and I would take this down to verse 8, first verse, verses 1 to 8. And then what are we to listen to? We listen to the story of, I'm calling it, Israel's loss and their behavior. Take the, generally down to verse 31, the lines between these sections are not hard and fast, but thereabouts. And then from 32 to 39, we especially see God's dealings with Israel. And then the way I would present it today is from verse 40 through to 64, we have those two sections really all over again. And to wrap up, concluding with verses 65 to the end is Judah's gain. And I will explain as we go along. So we have, first of all, the call to listen, verses 1 through to 8. Give ear, O my people, to my law. Incline your ears to the words of my mouth. Pay attention. I said it a moment ago. As the New Testament puts it, he who has ears, put your hand up if you don't. If you have ears, hear what the Spirit is saying. Give your ears. Incline your ears. I know there are times when there's a whole lot of noise going on and around and somebody wants to say something. I do incline, I lean towards them to ensure that it's them that I hear. Do you? With God? Do these people? Why should you do this? Because what we have told here is worth listening to. It's valuable for you. In this case, things from the past. Worth hearing, worth thinking about, contemplating, along with Asaph. It's called a parable. Dark sayings of old. Parable, perhaps a bit different from what we're used to thinking of like that when we come to Jesus. But the essence of the thing is the same. You are told certain things, and you are expected to think them through. Consider the implications of them. Make an assessment. Come to an understanding regarding yourself and your situation in the light of the things that are told here. Jesus told true-to-life stories as parables, and the people who were to hear were to find the insight, understand how that applied to them. You have true-to-life stories here from Israel's story. We are to understand the implications for us, as well as those first hearers. How does that apply? How does that teach you concerning yourself and your circumstances? The way that God deals with you. In the New Testament, Paul particularly talks about mysteries. You might say, well, isn't that what he means by dark sayings of old? Well, perhaps, yes. But Paul's saying mysteries, they are things that were obscure, but they're not. And they ought not to be. They're open. God makes them open. If we trust in his insight and his spirit. Well, it's much like that here. These things could be kept obscure. But he's saying we have heard them. We have known them. In verse 3, our fathers have told us. These things are in the public domain. But perhaps most striking is their history. Who listens to history? We ought to learn. Fathers were told by God to tell his works and his words to their children. Back in Deuteronomy chapter 6, do it wherever you are, in every place where you are with your people. Our fathers have told us. And so, that tremendous passage, we will not hide them from their children, and so on. It develops through three verses, driving the point home. We will tell these things, his strength, his wonderful works, the law that he's appointed. We'll make them known to their children that the generation to come might know them. But why is all this? Why is this important? Perhaps I should also add, they're telling them in a way that their children will know. They will keep on telling. They'll go back over it, over and over again, so that their children will know. Why? Because this, they seek the greatest treasure of all for their children. Mums, dads, you might seek a good career for your children, that they can live a comfortable life, and perhaps even more. No treasure is worth this, as much as this, teaching the works and the words of God. Why? That they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. Verse 7. That's the great objective. Let that be your great objective. Young people, before long you will be as we are, old and having children. You teach your children and your grandchildren so that they may set their hope in God. There is no hope to compare. It's a tremendous objective that Asaph reflects here. Let there be no desire greater than this in any family than that the successive generations will set their hope in God. It is the most important truth. The reason God gave the law, we are told, is in order that it should be passed on. He established this testimony in Jacob. He didn't just lie it down so that anybody passing by, he chose a people that in that people he could put his law, his testimony. That's why he has his church. That's why we believe in the covenant in his church. And the children are part of the church. And it must go on and on. That's his purpose. That he will have a people. But then you also see very quickly the alternative. And it brings us close, much closer to the overall theme of the psalm. In verse 8. But verse 7, let me read it again, that they may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments, into verse 8, and may not be like their fathers. If their fathers, the previous generations, had suffered so much, if their fathers had brought the nation to their knees, isn't it possible to discover why? How that came about? And to avoid the same mistakes. That's what this is saying. Very simply. Set your hope in God. Don't be stubborn and rebellious. Don't fail to set your heart aright. May your spirit be faithful to God in contrast to the way of the fathers of Israel. And that is where the psalm then takes off, as it were, to remember those things and gain benefit by avoiding those dangers. And so the bulk of the psalm deals with Israel's loss and behavior. And I do put it in this way because that's the way that the psalm tells it. It points to Ephraim. I do use Israel. The reason is that when you see the name of Ephraim being used, it's far more likely to come later on when the nation was divided after David and Solomon. That's what the northern kingdom often was called, because they were the leading tribe, the dominant tribe. In the time of some of the earliest of the writing prophets, Hosea and Isaiah and so on, Ephraim and Judah are distinguished from one another, the north and the south. And here we hear of the Lord's problem with Ephraim. 9 and 10, they did not keep the covenant of God. They refused to walk in his law, forgot his works and the wonders he had shown them. Underlying this really quite simple retelling of the story. Is the sense here that Ephraim lost their tremendous opportunities to prosper under the Lord's favor? They had all they needed. They were armed. They were carrying bows, but they turned back. They lacked the courage to go on in the name and the strength of the Lord. Think of Joshua as he went out with that promise. Be strong and courageous. The Lord will be with you. Ephraim said, I'm going back. They failed. They lost those opportunities. Why was that? Because of that warped heritage that they fell back on instead of relying upon the Lord and His testimony that we've just read of. This section does include things that God did, but mainly it's to set the scene for a reflection on Ephraim's or Israel's responses. It tells us, for example, it's about the marvelous things he did in the sight of their fathers, and so on through the sea, leading them through the wilderness with the clouds and the fire, splitting the rocks, giving water. But the reflection is down in verse 17. They sinned even more against him. So those first examples, they take us through the deliverance from Egypt, and something that was often set before the people, especially in those days of the prophets, of the winding down of the kingdom for a time before the exile. They reminded them, what happened in Egypt? Do you remember what happened there? And what that means? This is what the psalm is about. What do you think you were saved for, in other words? And then do follow the various references to the other events in their wilderness wanderings. The rocks out of which the water came, and their challenge, yes, they said, okay, he's done that. Can he give bread also? Can he provide meat for his people? In verse 20. It's downright cheek, really, isn't it? How often men do precisely that. These things are simply reminders in just a few verses of the things that are thoroughly documented in those earlier books, Exodus through to Deuteronomy. But what's especially important is this, to hear how Israel reacted. After all that God had done, they sinned even more against him by rebelling and testing him, asking for the food of their fancy, spoke against God. And so you have this summary record of events. It stops and it starts, as it were, and interspersing with explanations. There are these cycles of great works and of benefits that they received. And what happens next? They test God. It's God's anger that follows on that, with reason. Give you an example. I'm not going to go through all the details in the psalm. But for an example, you come down to verse 22. In verse 21, we hear that God was furious. His anger came up against Israel. And there is a reason for it. It's not that God is like human beings or any other spiritual being. Not the angels, of course, but the principalities and powers. It's not that he's like them with his anger. There is a reason. Because they did not believe in God, did not trust in his salvation. God's anger has a foundation. And I encourage you to read this psalm again slowly and follow this deliberate exposition of that history that they went through. So you have a record of Israel's behavior and what they lost as a result of it. They were subject to God's anger and all that follows from that. Whether they were subject to blessing or to punishment, we find that Israel shows persistent disbelief, unbelief. And so what do we find that God did with them then? God's dealings with Israel. I'll take you then to We'll take it as a section from 32 to 39. In spite of this, they still sinned, did not believe his wondrous works. In this section, the main emphasis is on God's intentions rather than Israel's response to his work. It's what is God's heart towards Israel? And within it, to expound that, are some of their further responses. They persistently refuse to trust in him. God, therefore, afflicted them. Therefore, again that key word, therefore or because, therefore their days he consumed in futility and their years in fear. Doesn't that describe so well? Consumed their days in futility, their wanderings for years, and wandering is futile. It's just going about from here to there and getting nowhere. But that was the result, that was the consequence of their disbelief, which was sin. God afflicted them. There were some occasions when we are told that they did return and they sought diligently for God. In verse 34, remember that God was their rock and the Most High God their Redeemer. You can go back, and that again is to trigger the thoughts of the story, how there were times when they did suffer and then they cried out to God and said, God, save us. And God did. That's reflected here. They sought diligently. They did remember. But we learn that even that was a lie. It was a temporary recollection. It was to suit themselves. It was to get some temporary escape and relief. It's not that God couldn't see that. But he did reward to some degree that expression that they came back and spoke of their remembering of him. But we know that they did lie. They flattered him with their mouth, for their heart was not steadfast. They were not faithful in his covenant. They did not keep his commandments, his testimony. Remember that this is the recalling of Israel's ways and God's ways with them. So many generations after these events, God's people were being called to remember and consider, to think it through. They were to remember that there was a time when God himself led them through futility and fear. But they were to remember too that he forgave their iniquity and did not destroy them, in verse 38. But to ask themselves why. Why did God do this work? Whether it was that leading them so that their lives were futile, or to forgive them and to care for them. Why? Look at the contrast. We've just read in verse 37, their heart, what do you see in man's heart? It was not steadfast. Then you see he being full of compassion. That's his heart. You have a direct contrast being set in front of you here. Man was not steadfast, was not faithful. He was full of compassion, regardless of that, as it were. To overcome that, he was full of compassion. And that compassion was enough to turn his anger away, not to stir up his wrath. It's as though his anger is there. It's righteously there. It could well have been administered on the people, but what happens? Because of his heart, he says, I'm not going to use that. I'm going to be kind. I'm going to be forgiving towards them. He considered their weakness. And that's a tremendous call to humility. We don't think of our weakness very often. Man doesn't. But it's a great restraint in God's heart to say, well, really, they're utterly helpless. I will forgive. Christ himself looked on those people as sheep without a shepherd, just wandering all over the place, lives futile, and his heart went out in great compassion. And so that's traced out for us here in the great heart of God towards his people. The following section from 40, and I would take it down to 64, I'm saying all over again. We are around halfway through this psalm. It is worth treading slowly through the rest, because there are certain things that we are reminded of there, and the plagues in Egypt, for example. He's turned back further again. I can only urge you to look through it again in the light of what I'm setting before you today, to keep that shape in mind as you go through and see what God is doing here as well. The psalm really is something I would liken it to going down to the shore, and there are breakers. Go to a place where you've got decent breakers and you'll see the picture. It's like the water is coming in and it builds up and then it tumbles over, and it's as though that wave is gone. But there's another one to follow, and it's happening here as well. That the story goes through and builds up, and it comes to the place where God says, and this is how I deal with them. And then it starts again, almost from nothing, back to Egypt. And the way that God did his mighty works of judgment against Egypt, but also of deliverance of the people. And it starts to build up all over again. It's not just building, going from that same point in the story where he's just come to. He goes back again to the key, probably the key event in Israel's history. Their redemption, their deliverance from bondage. And that in itself should come directly to our hearts as to our deliverance from the bondage of sin. And that's what we have in the pattern of this story, of this psalm, taking us along to lay out the crucial lesson: how will you respond to God in his grace, but also in his anger? And then comes back to do much the same thing again, telling more of the provocations. Just to open up this section very quickly, in verse 40, look at some of the key words here. Look at what the people did to God. First, they provoked, then they grieved. That's just one verse. They tempted God, they limited the Holy One of Israel. Four disastrous things in two verses. In verse 42, they did not remember, they forgot, and so on. Takes them back with perhaps just a little more detail. From verse 41 through to verse 42 through to 51, you really have the way that he afflicted Egypt, the plagues as we call them, and then those powerful openings through to verse 55, opening the sea and taking them through, brought them to his holy border. He drove out the nations before them, taking them into the promised land. And then that word, yet, verse 56. He's done all of this. It was introduced first that they had provoked, they had forgotten all of these things. To remind you now, he's done all of this for them, yet in verse 56. Yet, just that word, yet. But, again, they tested and provoked. Surely you can't be inclined to forget how God dealt with, or the people dealt with God after all this. Fourteen verses of God's great works, all undermined by their neglect of him. Not just his words, but him. They failed him. They did not remember him. Many will tell you today that the Old Testament God is an angry God. Yes, you read a psalm like this. They provoked him to anger in verse 58. He is an angry God, many times. But is that the whole story? You know it's not. Look at the God that you have in this psalm, a God of compassion. A God who sets something there that says, I will be the hope of you and every successive generation if you hold to my testimony. This is the God who then is provoked by men. Ought we to be surprised that he shows his anger? They provoked him to anger. I'm the one who has brought Egypt, the might and the power of Egypt, to nothing. I have taken you out and across the sea. into a new land and driven out the nations, and what will you do? You'll go to the high places and your images, and you'll worship them. Is it any wonder his cross? Things of their own imaginations and making they serve. And so Asaph, the one of his line, says to the people, learn and don't forget. The provocation is in the forgetting. There's one reason, a very simple one, why God is angry. And it's the same reason why Jesus, the God, as it were, of the New Testament, is also angry on occasion. It's because men that he had loved, men that he had blessed, were faithless. That's what it is. And it's in consequence of that we learn in this passage that he forsook, he left, he abandoned even the tabernacle in verse 60, the tent he had placed among men. He left it. He gave his people over in verse 62 to the sword. And that was it, as it were. It's all done. The people are gone. The temple is gone. The tent is gone. That's it. This people that he's done so much for, nowhere to be seen. Except, we come to the last part. He rejected that tent of Joseph. He did not choose the tribe of Ephraim. That became the target, as it were, towards the end of that passage. But he made a choice. It does seem to be a little bit of an odd picture, perhaps, to use of the Lord, but it's very effective. It's as though the Lord didn't count, seem to care in the least. Completely switched off, as it were, from his people. But the time came when he rose up in his might, stretching his strength, and he was irresistible. He beat back his enemies. And instead of his chosen people being forsaken and completely disappeared, there were some that he would care for. It would be the enemies that would be under perpetual reproach forever. Yes, he is not forgotten. Men have forgotten. God has not forgotten. He tells us the process of elimination, not that he's looking at them and considering and so on. He has his choice, and he says, not you, not you. Judah is the one. And he goes all the way down to David specifically. In verse 70, he chose David, his servant. Notice in these few remaining verses, there are two key things that God puts in place. There's the central worship of the Lord, the Most High. He built his sanctuary like the heights, like the earth, which he has established forever, an eternal and everlasting sanctuary, place of his worship. But he has also set up a line, the line of David, to shepherd his people. The rule, the service, the life, the worship and life that the Lord tells us he has established here. We might well go back to the story of the 12 sons of Jacob, and there you would find certain reasons why the first three sons of Jacob were not chosen as leaders. Judah was the fourth son. But then it's striking that here we have the rejection of Joseph in Egypt. Joseph was Jacob's favorite son, but not for God. God had another purpose. He chose Judah, who was himself a very sinful man, but he chose him. All of this, I think, is telling us that really in man there is nothing to warrant God's choosing. Judah was just as much part of that rebellious people in the wilderness. But the Lord was a covenant-making and keeping God. He will keep his people. And here I think you might see one of those examples where he chooses the unexpected. We find with hindsight that they were entirely the right choice. He chose David from among the sheepfolds. That's the story of David, isn't it? When Samuel went to anoint him as the next king. But what a choice it was. David as a shepherd, to shepherd the people, the nation of God, just as Moses before him, just as Christ the Good Shepherd to follow. Judah did gain favor with God by God's own will. And so God established his worship and his rule amongst men. Men therefore gained, but overall it is that God might be glorified. In closing, surely it remains and will remain for a long time a puzzle why mankind and each successive wave, whether it's generations or whatever form it takes, insist on making the same mistakes as those who've gone before them. Many, if not most people, are willing to pass on the things that they have learned. Yet it seems that so few of us are ready to listen and to learn, unless we go through personal experience. I think it's a sure sign of our ingrained sinfulness. Let's put it that way. It's original sin. That's what we are. We think that we can go into the same situation that Mum or Dad have gone into and do better than them, all without bothering to hear of their experience or learn from them. Pride is there from the very beginning. Self-confidence. And we're reminded of those things, I think, by this call to learn and to listen, to hear. But it's about even more than that. The psalm is about God at work. And he has not stopped working. You look at your life and consider, contemplate how many good things he has done for you. Consider your heritage, the families from which you've come. Consider his providence and how he's led you to be where you are today. God gives such rich blessings. Israel took them for their own desire, with hardly a glance to the giver. They presumed on their right to them. There only needs to be one lesson here. It does take all this time and more to teach it, to learn it. Because you don't listen the first time, do you? Not often. The writer is going over one example, and he adds another, and he adds another. Eventually, with the implied question, do you see a pattern forming here? Think about that pattern. Why? Don't forget sin. It's God's right, his prerogative. He says he will forget our sin if we come to him in Christ. But it's not your right to do it. It's your right to learn from it. It's your duty to learn from it. Look at the patterns. They're no different today. When God works like this for his people, in the end the question goes back to what the purpose of it all was. I will tell you these things, he says. Why? That they, the one who hears, may set their hope in God and not forget the works of God, but keep his commandments. Will you set your hope, not be like those fathers, but instead be faithful to the God who is so kind? May God bless his word to us on that same count today, to his praise.